From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Chairman Powell is engaged in the most broad-ranging reevaluation of media ownership rules that has taken place in 50 years.
Former FCC Chair Reed Hunt, Juan Gonzalez, Bob McChesney, and others warn FCC commissioners not to scrap all rules against media consolidation. And Chumbawamba joins us live in our Firehouse studio.
Hi, we're Chumbawamba, and we're here because we're going to go to the big anti-war rally in Washington on Saturday, and we're going to be playing Jacob's Ladder there, which is a song that we had before, but we changed the words so that they're anti-war and they're against Bush's sentiment, which is kick his ass, then get the gas.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The global justice movement won a major victory in the courts yesterday when the Ninth Circuit Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco emphatically stated that international trade agreements do not supersede U.S. laws. That statement was part of a larger ruling blocking President Bush's plans to open all American highways to tens of thousands of Mexican trucks. The court ruled the Bush administration must conduct an environmental review. The lawsuit was brought by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the California Trucking Association, the Environmental Law Foundation, and Public Citizen. These groups feared that admitting Mexican trucks would hurt the air and water, endanger safety, and take jobs from U.S. truck drivers. Mexican drivers often earn $7 an hour, about one-third the pay of many Teamsters drivers. Father Daniel Berrigan and 17 others were arrested yesterday during a sit-in at the Armed Services Recruiting Station in Times Square. Among those arrested was Carmen Trotta of the Catholic Worker.
We were able to obstruct government administration. As was said, that was the charge against us, closing down what is the busiest recruiting center in the United States there in Times Square. Many people will look at the holiday of Dr. Martin Luther King and remember the speech, "I Have a Dream." We must all remember that just a couple of years later, Dr. King himself was saying that the dream had become a nightmare, that domestic and foreign poverty were closely related to American militarism abroad. We're looking at a massive assault on Iraq, and so we did our action in the name and memory of Dr. King and in the hopes of preserving the lives of hundreds of thousands in Iraq.
Carmen Trotta of the Catholic Worker, 17 others were arrested at a similar action in Los Angeles. Chicago City Council voted 46-1 to oppose a preemptive attack on Iraq. Council members said there's no evidence that Iraq poses an imminent threat or that an attack would result in an Iraqi democracy. According to citiesforpeace.org, Chicago is the 39th city to pass an anti-war resolution. Meanwhile, the time.com poll continues. More than 90% of respondents say that the greatest threat to world peace in 2003 is the United States. More than three-quarters of those responding say that. United Nations weapons inspectors discovered a dozen empty chemical warheads in Iraq yesterday. Iraq said the stocks were old weapons and had been mentioned in its declaration last month, as well as in 1996. The Bush administration is assessing whether the discovery could constitute a violation of UN Security Council resolutions. Relatives of two people killed in the Washington region sniper case yesterday sued the manufacturer of the Bushmaster rifle used in the shooting and the store where it was bought or stolen. The family members say that if the gun maker and store had acted responsibly in the sale of their guns, the snipers would not have been able to obtain the assault rifle. According to the lawsuit, in the last 3 years, over 200 guns have disappeared from the Bullseye Shooter Supply Store in Tacoma, Washington. The Justice Department has expanded the controversial registration program for immigrants. Now all males over 16 from Kuwait, Egypt, Jordan, Indonesia, and Bangladesh must register with the INS. At the same time, officials extended the registration deadline for people from 18 of the 20 countries already on the list. The new deadline is February 7th. Meanwhile, seven men detained by the INS have gone on a hunger strike to protest their detention and their treatment in New Jersey's Passaic County Jail. The hunger strikers are demanding the release of all 911 detainees, most of whom are not charged with crimes and have not been linked to terrorism or violence. On average, they have been held without bond for over a year. The Washington Post is reporting National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice took a rare central role in a domestic debate within the White House and helped persuade President Bush to publicly condemn the University of Michigan's affirmative action program. Administration officials said Rice had a series of lengthy one-on-one meetings with Bush and drew on her experience as provost at Stanford University to help convince him that affirmative action is not an effective way of improving diversity on college campuses. Just before midnight last night, the administration filed briefs arguing that the University of Michigan's undergraduate and law school admissions programs are unconstitutional. The New York Times is reporting the Bush administration has ruled states can place limits and restrict coverage of emergency services for poor people on Medicaid. Previously, managed care organizations had to provide coverage for Medicaid patients in any situation that a, quote, prudent layperson would regard as an emergency. Officials at the University of California at Berkeley have reversed course and decided they no longer have to gag anarchist Emma Goldman after all. Goldman died over 60 years ago, but Associate Vice Chancellor Robert Price still decided to delete two quotations by Goldman from a fundraising letter for the university's Emma Goldman Archive. He was concerned they might be construed as university opposition to Bush administration plans for war with Iraq. Ironically, in one of the censored quotations, Goldman warned that advocates of free speech, quote, shall soon be obliged to meet in cellars or in darkened rooms with closed doors. In the other, she called on people, quote, not yet overcome by war madness, to raise their voice of protest.
It's a long walk to the gallows, it's a small step to swing free. They're crying in the tower for my conspirators and me. Gunpowder and modem and a dream of liberty. And then they'll tell you, don't try this at home. Oh yes, they'll tell you, don't try this at home. If you walk on the streets with King Canute, you'll be walking back alone. Tonight he'll dine on oysters while we fall like green acorns. We'll be putting down our roots right in the center of the storm. And then they'll tell you, don't try this at home. Oh yes, they'll tell you, don't try this at home.
Chumbawamba live in our Firehouse studio. They will be singing a new song, Jacob's Ladder, on Saturday at the major anti-war protests in Washington. We'll be talking with them later in the program. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez met with U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan at the United Nations yesterday. Chavez has asked the U.N. and neighboring countries to help mediate the standoff between the government and opposition forces. In recent weeks, a business lockout and work stoppage led by right-wing groups aiming to bring down the president has devastated the petroleum industry. In a news conference after the meeting, President Chavez was asked how much oil the country is currently exporting every day.
Above 33%. We're getting close to 40% of our production under OPEC allotments. It's a result of sabotage, sabotage by subversive groups, physical sabotage of installations. They did damage to facilities, and there's also technological sabotage. The computers, for example, were damaged. Systems where gas is mixed, all of that is computerized. It's all very modernized, and they made changes in the controls. They blocked the computers. They took away some keys, personal keys in some cases. There was an anti-patriotic group that subverted their country, real traitors, and they really struck at the very heart of Venezuela. So we lost over 2,000 high officials. We've made a change in the regional managers for exploration, exploitation. We've changed all the managers of the refineries. We've recovered the ships. There are still two or three ships that are not moving. We're putting together new crews for them. So they had a plan. They thought it was a perfect plan, but they failed, just as they failed in April. They failed in the oil coup of December, just as they failed in the military coup in April. So we're taking up the industry again. We are reactivating refineries day after tomorrow, Saturday. Rafael Ramirez is here. You can ask him. He can give you more details. But we're at about 1 million barrels a day, and the day after tomorrow I'm going to be going to the El Palito refinery because we're starting up in some of the refineries there as well.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez speaking at the United Nations yesterday. Democracy Now! Producer Alex Wolf was there. He asked Venezuelan Energy Minister Rafael Ramirez whether foreign high technology firms such as the major U.S. defense contractor Science Applications International Corporation had been cooperating with the Venezuelan government. SAIC supplied much of the technology and computer systems that regulate the refineries and pipelines in Venezuela, as well as navigational and global positioning systems for the oil tankers. This U.S. company, computing company, SAIC, has among its directors ex-U.S. Secretaries of Defense William Perry and Melvin Laird, ex-directors of the CIA John Deutsch, Robert Gates, Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, ex-director of the National Security Agency, and other retired military staff, including Wayne Downing, former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Special Forces, and Jasper Welch, ex-coordinator of the National Security Council. This was Venezuelan Energy Minister Rafael Ramirez's response.
Offers in private companies because we're changing our path with companies that supported the sabotage and the shipping lines that supported the sabotage. We're changing our commercial relations with many companies. It is an excellent opportunity for any firm that wants to have a presence in Venezuela, the number one petroleum producer in the Western Hemisphere, and we are reviewing all possibilities.
Venezuelan Energy Secretary Rafael Ramirez. You are listening to Democracy Now! Yesterday, because of the activism of a number of media groups, Columbia Law School held a public hearing on the Federal Communications Commission's plans to loosen or scrap all remaining media ownership rules. FCC Chair Michael Powell was forced to attend because of the increased interest in this issue. The FCC until now has said they would only hold one official hearing in Richmond, Virginia. While this wasn't an official hearing, it was brought together by a dissident FCC board member, FCC commissioner named Michael Copps. Powell said he didn't believe in public hearings, apparently pressured, though, into attending. The six rules under review include the ban on broadcasters owning television stations that reach more than 35% of the country, the prohibition of mergers between the four largest TV networks, and the prohibition from owning a newspaper and broadcast outlet in the same market. If those rules are scrapped, a single CEO could theoretically own all of the largest media outlets in the country. Just before the hearing, we were able to reach Reed Hunt, former chair of the FCC.
Chairman Powell is engaged in the most broad-ranging reevaluation of media ownership rules that has taken place in 50 years. He essentially believes that as technologies converge, it's appropriate to allow companies to own a number of different media outlets, possibly newspaper and TV station, maybe even cable channels all in the same town. This is a very important proceeding because it raises the question of whether democracy is served by the existing rules or whether democracy, in fact, can continue to survive and maybe even flourish if we consolidate the media in a few conglomerates.
The latest quote of Michael Powell is that the agency would not allow one company to dominate local airwaves or other media outlets when it revisits the longstanding rules under the court order. He was quoted saying to the Senate Commerce Committee, "I am skeptical that some of the more melodramatic versions of what's likely to come out of the commission are actually an accurate reflection of what the majority of the commission thinks."
Well, he seems to want some kind of consolidation or he wouldn't be getting the eraser out.
Who do you think is driving this?
Well, I think that Chairman Powell is a person of integrity, and he has long believed that there are too many rules and more consolidation is appropriate.
You have basically said that this kind of reevaluation that could lead to media concentration undermines democracy. How?
You know, it's very, very important for democracy to have lots of different viewpoints expressed by the owners of the different media. But it's also very important for people who want to get access to the media to have lots of channels to use, to have lots of methods to get their message across. If I want to write an editorial for a newspaper or go on a TV show, it's better for me, in terms of expressing my opinion, to not have them all be owned by the same person who might not like me.
Former FCC Chair Reed Hundt. We now go to yesterday's hearing and begin with the statement of Charles Lewis, Executive Director of the Center for Public Integrity. His organization did research exposing the close relationship between the FCC, Congress, and media corporations.
But the media corporations gave $75 million to Congress over a five-year period, as much really as many key special interests. They spent $111 million on lobbying with all the top blue chip firms to get their way. And one of the moments of flex muscle that we saw was with free airtime for politicians. Clinton, in his State of the Union address, proposed it. Kennard, the next day, said he was starting a rulemaking process. And about 2 weeks later, it was dead in the water because dozens of letters had poured in from Congress, who said, if you continue with this silliness, we'll defund your agency. End of story. Welcome to reality. The broadcast industry is extraordinarily powerful because not only do they do all the things special interests do, they control whether or not your mug is on the tube or on the airwaves. That's power. But then there's the Federal Communication Commission. We found, we found that 1,400 trips, all expense-paid trips, were paid for by broadcasters and other media companies for FCC personnel. How can the FCC judge and discuss media ownership if they're taking trips from these guys? Call me crazy, but I have a problem with that. We found that members of Congress, the same ones who voted the Telecom Act, took 315 trips around the world paid for by media companies. Time Warner took House Commerce Chairman Tozan and his wife to Paris for six nights for $19,000. We don't know where they stayed from the records, but I have a feeling it was not Le Holiday Inn. And so there is a perception, I'm sorry, I think it's more than a perception, of incredible closeness of this agency. It goes back decades. It's not just the current administration.
That was Chuck Lewis, founder and executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, speaking at the Columbia Law School Forum on Media Ownership. Among those who spoke was Juan Gonzalez and Bob McChesney. But first, we're going to turn to Ellen Agress, senior vice president of the Fox Entertainment Group. There was industry as well as grassroots organizations that were represented. This is Ellen Agress of Fox Entertainment Group.
Stations, Inc. In its notice of proposed rulemaking, the Commission correctly formulates the central issue in the rulemaking proceeding as, can it justify retention of the ownership regulations given the dramatic increases in competition evident in today's media marketplace? And the answer to that query is clearly no. The Commission, the notice of rulemaking also correctly recognizes two factors that must guide and shape its deliberation on the central issue: a radically changed media marketplace, and a mandate from both Congress and the courts for a change in the way the FCC regulates that marketplace. And I think Chairman Powell aptly described what that is. And I would urge the Commission that it must move away from acting on the basis of anecdotes and emotion and visceral reactions to big must be bad. It must base its decision on real facts about the media marketplace and clear-headed analysis of those facts. and determine through that analysis whether the marketplace provides enough competition to protect and advance its policy goals, namely competition, diversity, and localism. Fox believes that when today's marketplace is empirically examined and rationally analyzed, it will compel the conclusion that no regulation of media ownership is required beyond the proper application of this country's antitrust laws. Together with NBC Telemundo and Viacom, Fox filed extensive comments in the FCC's rulemaking that support this call for deregulation with hard data and thorough economic analysis. I obviously don't have time to recap everything we said this morning, but let me make at least a few of the comments' most salient points. The overwhelming weight of the evidence demonstrates that today's vast and diverse media marketplace provides more than enough competition to ensure that the Commission's policy goals will be met. To illustrate the point, and only to illustrate it, we examined two markets, a large market and a small market, to see what's happened over the last 40 years. And let me say that is the examination that the Commission needs to do has to look at a local market where a proposed combination is proposed, not at how many stations or programming services or whatever a company may own across the country, because what affects the consumer is what happens in his local market. How many choices does, from different viewpoints, different owners, different outlets, does that consumer have? I won't go through the numbers. They're in our comments. But there has been a multiplying many-fold of the number of broadcast outlets, the number of, obviously, cable and DBS has come on the scene, it didn't even exist in 1960. The number of local magazines has increased dramatically. The number of neighborhood and suburban newspapers has increased dramatically in both large and small markets. And even if you adjust for commonly owned media, the average consumer has a tremendous choice amongst these competing sources of viewpoints and information.
Ellen Agress, Senior Vice President of Fox Entertainment Group. When we come back, we'll get response from, among others, the head of the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters. Stay with us as we continue with Chumbawamba in our Firehouse studio.
Like the sermon on the mountain, says the dumber got dumb. Hellfire and brimstone swapped for oil and gum. When we're pushing up daisies, we all look the same. In the name of the Father, maybe, but not in my name. Unless Jacob's ladder, the only way up is down. One step from disaster, two to make the higher ground. Jacob's ladder.
Pump it up, leader, sooner or later. We'll dig up the cellar, try it for murder. Puppy dog leader, sooner or later. We'll dig up the cellar, try it for murder. This is four lines of a poem by Andrew Motion, and he wrote it about the war against Iraq, and here it is. They read good books and quote but never learn a language other than the scream of rocket burn. Our straighter talk is dry but ironclad. Elections, money, empire, oil and dad.
You are listening to Democracy Now! Chumbawamba in our Firehouse studio. We'll be speaking with them later in the program. Right now, we go back to the FCC Forum at Columbia University Law School. James Winston testified before the commissioners, though it wasn't an official forum. He's executive director and general counsel for the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters.
History. NABOB is a trade association. We represent the interests of African American owners of radio and television stations across the country. NABOB was founded in 1976. At the time, there were no African Americans who owned any television stations across the country, and African Americans only owned 30 radio stations across the country. The association was founded to try to correct this disparity. Today, African Americans own approximately 240 radio stations and 20 television stations. To put that in perspective, there are approximately 1,000 commercial television stations across the country and about 12 or 13,000 commercial radio stations across the country. I think that's important because Chairman Powell was talking about metrics and how do we measure impacts and how do we measure from one biennial review to another. It would be great if we could say in the last biennial review, 10% of broadcast outlets were owned by minorities, and now they're only 3%. The fact of the matter, there's never been higher than 3% of all minorities. So that when you talk about using metrics to determine what's wrong with the industry, there are no metrics to use because we never owned enough of the industry to have a measurable means of predicting what would happen if we didn't own anything. So if you look at what's going on in the industry today, it's a very fundamental question of how the American public will receive its news and information. That's the principal issue. Yes, entertainment is important too, but the principal issue is news and public affairs. That's what the First Amendment was designed to try to protect, and that's what the commission, over its many years of fostering minority ownership, was trying to promote. In 1978, when the commission adopted its minority ownership policy, it recognized that the First Amendment is best served when there are diverse voices that can present news and information, that can present viewpoints. Throughout its history, since 1978 until very recently, the commission has thought that was an important public interest objective for its rules. Where we are now, after the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and I'm glad you got an awful lot of background information on the creation of the Telecommunications Act from the Congressman Adler here, because what happened was there was this huge debate about the baby bells and how much power they'd be given over the telecommunications industry and how much competition could be provided from long-distance companies, et cetera. As the congressman said, at the 13th hour, a very effective lobbying campaign was created to add in some major deregulation of the broadcast industry, and particularly the elimination of any cap on national radio ownership. When you look at that, at the time, no company could own more than 40 AM radio stations and 40 FM radio stations. Now there is no limit on how many stations one company can own nationwide. As a result, we have one company, Clear Channel, which now has, according to the most recent figures, 1,211 radio stations across the country. They're in almost every major market in America, and they have multiple stations in all of those markets. For African Americans, the radio rules are critical. Television is where the bulk of Americans get their news and information, and certainly African Americans get the bulk of their news and information there too. We own too few of those stations to even have the ability to influence debate over television. We are left only with radio, and we only have 240 radio stations. So when the commission says it's a biennial review and everything's on the table, including radio ownership rules, we naturally get very concerned. Radio is the last bastion for African Americans to have any voice in the national debate of important issues. And it's critical to understand how ownership affects the national debate. Media companies of every stripe put news on the air. The question is, who decides what is news? Who's going to be the news director? Who's going to be the assignment editor? Who's going to decide what gets covered? Those things have to start at the top. It all starts from the top and goes down. And I see I didn't get a warning sign. Okay. I'm running out of time. But I want to say that the principal questions here are, who's going to decide who gets what news? Who's going to decide what programming gets on the air, whether it's public affairs or entertainment programming? Who is going to decide? If minorities are not making any of those decisions, the American public as a whole will lose out. Thank you.
James Winston, Executive Director of the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters. Bob McChesney also spoke. He is author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy.
First of all, I'd like to echo the point that Congressman Nadler made, which I think is absolutely crucial, which is that the provisions about deregulating or loosening media ownership that are called for, at least the review that's called for in the 1996 Telecommunications Act, was not the result of an informed, feisty debate within Congress, even within the committees. It was an afterthought, to be generous. I've spoken to members of the relevant committee in the House who didn't even know the radio material deregulation was in the bill itself that they voted on, their own committee sent through. I think a significant percentage of members of Congress had no idea what was going on. Now, I can understand that the courts might say, well, that's irrelevant. The Congress passed it. How they passed it, it's not our business. They passed it. But I would say that the FCC is held to a different standard. The statute also calls for it to respond and reflect and represent the public interest, the same legislation that calls for the biennial review. Likewise, as Mr. Edelstein pointed out, the Red Line decision, another Supreme Court decision, makes it quite clear that the FCC has clear obligations with regard to the public interest that are every bit as paramount as the most recent decision regarding deregulation. I think that what Mr. Powell spoke about, to his great credit, and I think it's absolutely true, is that there are tremendous claims about deregulation, the benefits of them that need to be examined. We have to have hard evidence. We need to look at them. And I think the preliminary record we see with radio is unequivocal on this point, at least the initial look at radio. As Mr. Copps and Mr. Nadler have both spoken about, the deregulation or the loosening of radio ownership, and deregulation I think is a very misleading term because what you really have with deregulation is you still have significant regulation. I mean, you can't broadcast on Clear Channel or Viacom's frequencies. There's heavy regulation. What deregulation really means is regulation purely for private interests, without any pretense of regulating for the public. It's still heavily regulated. It's not deregulated. It's not free market. No one can go onto their frequencies. You go to jail if you go on their frequencies. But the claims for deregulation need to be studied and studied closely. With regard to radio, I think the evidence is coming in that the massive consolidation of ownership, while it may well have been a boon of tremendous value to the shareholders and the largest companies or to some of the people who have sold out their stations, has been anything but positive for listeners, for journalists, for communities. The decline in local journalism and localism, the increase in advertising and commercialism of the airwaves. These are the comments I receive constantly. This is what I see when I speak around the country. I think if the commission were to travel around the country and talk to people, this is what they would be inundated with, comments to this effect. I would argue that what the commission need to perhaps consider is a very serious, hard examination that goes far beyond what's presently proposed. I recall how Canada, when it first considered how to develop radio and television, its equivalent of the FCC at that time held public hearings in the 27 largest cities in Canada. The 27, you get number 27 in Canada, you're down to like Moose Jaw. And then they compiled public hearings in all 27 communities, then went to the Canadian Parliament with a report and said, this is what we found, now you debate it and come up with policies. This is too important for us three people, the Aird Commission, to make these decisions on our own. But that's, I would argue, democratic policymaking. I'd also argue that the idea that we can find quantitative evidence for everything is misleading. I love quantitative evidence. I use it in my research. But some things you can't just find scientific quantitative evidence for. It's just not possible. That doesn't mean you can't find an explanation. Read great history books. They use some quantitative evidence, but you can't do purely quantitative analysis of the Civil War or the American Revolution, or Christianity. Some things can't be put down into an equation. And just because you can't doesn't mean it can't be proven. We have real studies, so I'll close with just a few of the issues that demand very detailed, rigorous study before any deregulation should be done. First, journalism, as Ms. Mitchell talked about, there's a real crisis in journalism. Increasingly, there's evidence that what's good for these companies, what makes the most money, does not produce the best journalism. If we allow companies to conglomerate, known television, radio, cable companies within a community, there's a real concern you'll have one newsroom in these communities. And the real concern, there'll be a real lack of localism in these communities, lack of local journalism. Already a crisis, but it'll just get that much worse. There'll be much less coverage, if that's possible, of candidates in elections in our free media. Reduction where candidates basically get into bidding wars on political advertising. Also, this concentration, we have to examine how much it will accelerate the hyper-commercialism, which is evident across our media culture. The increase in the total amount of advertising, but even more ominously, the increase in the deterioration of the border between advertising and the editorial or creative part of our media. That's a real issue, especially with children, but in our journalism and across our culture. This has to be studied. We have to expect what will happen with conglomeration and concentration if we don't examine these issues. And then finally, my last point is the internet. Invariably, the arguments for deregulation come down to the point the internet changes everything. It sets us free. It introduces thousands and thousands of voices. We need real examination of exactly how the Internet's going to work this magical way. So far, there have been no commercially successful content providers generated by the Internet after 10 years. So it hasn't been provided a commercial alternative yet. To the extent it's been commercial, it's been incorporated by the largest companies. Likewise, to the extent the Internet does develop commercially, there's no evidence that it develops locally. And since so many of these deregulations will affect local communities and local markets, lead to concentration there, there's no reason to expect the Internet will solve that problem for us. I'd submit these are questions that need to be examined, and no credible public service can be done until it gets serious, slow, detailed examination and debate. Thank you.
Bob McChesney, of author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy, also testifying at the hearing on FCC ownership rules. Juan Gonzalez of Democracy Now!, president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists.
As people involved every day in producing news, my members have a unique perspective on the question before you. And as Latino journalists, we are painfully aware of the historical failings of our industry when it comes to serving the public interest and preserving diverse voices. A few weeks ago, the NEHJ released our 7th annual Network Brownout Report, which found that in 2001, less than 1% of all news stories on the network evening newscasts of ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN were about anything related to Latino issues. In the stories we reviewed, Latinos were too often stereotypically portrayed as illegal immigrants, as prone to violence, and as living in slums. This year, a study by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting found that 92% of all U.S. news sources who were interviewed on the nightly newscasts of ABC, CBS, and NBC in 2001 were white. It also found that of those 14,632 news sources quoted on the networks, 0.6% of them were Latino. So we're expert on nothing as far as the networks are concerned, but crime and immigration. A separate research done by the Wharton School professor Joel Waldfogel suggests that minorities are better served by minority-owned media outlets. One of the real issues confronting the commission that we're looking at is the planned merger of Univision and the Hispanic Broadcasting Corporation radio network. If this merger is approved by both the Justice Department and the FCC, it will grant to Univision, and by the way, Univision is not a Hispanic-owned network, neither is the Hispanic Broadcasting Corporation of 55 radio stations, will grant Univision 85% control of all Spanish-language media in the United States, both in radio and television. So the NEHJ is concerned about how lifting ownership caps will make it even harder to increase the little minority ownership that already exists among Hispanics in media. Furthermore, while our organization has not taken a final stand on each of the ownership restrictions you are reviewing, we are deeply troubled by the speed at which you are moving forward. You proposed in September to revamp a half dozen complex regulations for this before this spring, permanently altering the shape of the mass media in less time than it takes to complete an NBA basketball season. On January 2nd, we submitted to the FCC a long list of questions on how lifting caps would affect the news and information needs of 35 million Hispanic Americans. You see, for many of us, journalism is not just some consumer product like cornflakes or cars. At its best, it is a noble profession and a public service. It helps to right wrongs, it gives strength to the powerless, it informs and enlightens readers, viewers, and listeners about events outside their direct experience. But at its worst, journalism becomes the bait for the commercials. It distorts reality, inflames passions, reinforces stereotypes, marginalizes dissenting views, and functions as a mouthpiece for the powerful. No one is more aware than us how technology is fundamentally changing the way news and information is delivered, or how the rise of media conglomerates has radically altered the priorities of many news organizations. You've heard about Clear Channel, but the Washington Post quoted a Clear Channel executive who was running 26 stations in the Washington, D.C. area in a recent article. And the executive said, quote, "Every issue we discuss, every decision we make comes down to a simple test. Will it increase ratings or revenues? If it doesn't, let's move on." Now, Clear Channel is free to make all the money it wants, but as a broadcaster which gets a free license to use the public airwaves to serve the public interest, we ask, how can it do so when the company has virtually no news reporters, when even their disc jockeys are piping in the same playlist of songs to 20 or 40 stations from a different city? In closing, Supreme Court Justice Black declared back in 1945 in the Associated Press case that the First Amendment, quote, rests on the assumption that the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and antagonistic sources is essential to the welfare of the public. We urge you to take seriously the criticisms of some of the nation's most prominent journalists and scholars who keep warning about the negative relationship between media consolidation and the quality and diversity of news. Nothing less than the future of democratic discourse and the role of a free press is at stake. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
That was Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez, president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, speaking at the Columbia Law School Forum on FCC media ownership rules. We finally turn to Amy Mitchell, speaking at that forum. She is associate director with the Project for Excellence in Journalism.
Over the last 6 years, the Project for Excellence in Journalism has conducted a series of studies looking at the performance of the news media. These studies were designed to examine how journalism was impacted as a result of the changes in economics of the news business following the communications revolution. The findings of this research speak to some of the questions raised by Commissioner Copps as we're faced with another potential surge in consolidation and further change to the industry. There are four main points I'd like to make today. First, how the definition of news across different media have changed over the last 25 years. Second, how synergy works in network news. Third, five trends in local television news. And fourth, how journalists themselves feel about the changes that we can see. First, we examined how what constitutes news has changed over the last 25 years. In general, we found a decline in the seriousness of news and increases in lifestyle story and celebrity news. Our first study compared news content in the years of 1977, 87, and 97. The findings were evident across media, but particularly strong in network evening news. And that medium, what journalists consider traditional hard news, government, military, domestic, and foreign affairs, declined by more than a third. That decline coincided with increases in lifestyle and entertainment stories, which doubled. As of June 2001, the percent of traditional serious news was still less than half of the coverage. In the aftermath of September 11th, we saw serious news surge, but that surge was short-lived. By early 2002, those traditional hard news categories once again made up roughly half of the coverage. There was a short surge in hard news in early January of 2002 if we add in two traditionally not-so-serious subjects into the mix, but then it quickly declined once again. The evidence of our research suggests that this change is not unique to network news. We examined covers of weekly print news magazines and found that the percent of covers with political or international figures fell by more than 60% between 77 and 97. And instead, the covers were filled with celebrities. Newspapers have changed less in what they cover than the nightly network newscast, but other sectors of the news media that might be considered growth areas, such as primetime magazines on the network shows, virtually ignore completely the traditional areas of news coverage. Moving beyond the definition of news, we have also studied the influence of corporate synergy. In the fall and summer of 2001, we examined the network morning news programs to quantify the extent of product promotion and company synergy. We found that excluding commercials and local TV news inserts, network morning news shows dedicated a third of their time to selling viewers something. That something could be a book, a movie, a garden gadget, whatever. If you add to that the 35 minutes of commercials per program, more than half of every two-hour show was spent selling something. The next logical question, then, is the extent to which this selling peddles products from the parent company versus other companies. According to the study, ownership clearly makes a difference. Each show did more stories about their own parent company products than any other single company.
Amy Mitchell, Associate Director with the Project for Excellence in Journalism, speaking at the Columbia Law School Forum on FCC media ownership rules. Because of public pressure, there is going to be another forum on these FCC rules, which will be held at the University of Southern California. Michael Copps, the dissident commissioner, is trying to hold as many forums as he can. The official forum on FCC ownership rules of the media will be held in Richmond, Virginia. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. As we go now to Chumbawamba, here in our Firehouse studio.
Like a sermon on the mountain, says the Dharma got dumb. Hellfire and brimstone, swap for oil and guns. When we're pushing up daisies, we all look the same. In the name of the Father, maybe, but not in my name. On this Jacob's ladder, the only way up is down. One step from disaster, two to make the higher ground. Jacob's ladder.
Put our leader, sooner or later. We'll dig up the cellar, try it for murder.
Jacob's ladder.
Puppet dog leader, sooner or later. We'll dig up the cellar, try for murder.
You're listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Chumbawamba.
Like the sermon on the mountain, dying in the sun, on the streets of Whitehall, dogs picking at the bones. 9/11 got branded, 9/11 got sold. And there'll be no one left to water all the seeds you sowed. On this Jacob's ladder, the only way up is down. One step from disaster, two to make the higher ground. Jacob's ladder.
Put up leader, sooner or later. We'll dig up the cellar, try for murder.
Jacob's ladder.
Puppy dog leader, sooner or later. We'll dig up the cellar, try for murder.
And they sent him to the war to be slain, to be slain. And they sent him to the war to be slain. And they sent him to the war to be slain, to be slain. And they sent him to the war to be slain.
Chumbawamba. British band here at Democracy Now! As the British, as the Bush administration gears up for war against Iraq, artists and musicians are taking a more prominent role, giving voice to anti-war sentiments throughout the world. There's going to be a massive anti-war rally in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, as well as in cities around the United States. If the rally of October 26 is any indication, more than 100,000 people will be showing up in Washington, D.C. The British band Chumbawamba is going to be performing at the peace rally in Washington, D.C. to express their outrage at the proposed preemptive strike by the president-select. Four members of the band have joined us in our studio, Alice Nutter, Boff, Neil Ferguson, Lou Watts, and it's great to have you with us. You come from the land that has, where the leader has expressed the greatest solidarity with the Bush administration about over a preemptive attack on Iraq. What about the British population?
Yeah, the British population don't concur with Tony Blair. You know, we've got like up to 80% of the public in Britain are against this war. And Tony Blair doesn't really take those 80% of the people into account. You know, he's got his election coming up. He wants the votes 2 years' time.
What is the protest music like in Britain today? And how are you being received? What are you doing there?
There's a really strong tradition of protest music in Britain. And it didn't just start with punk rock, you know, right through from folk music. And so you get a lot of folk artists that are involved in issues outside, you know, outside singing about love and the cells. And you've also got bands like Blur and Massive Attack that are trying to organise musicians together into an anti-war coalition. So I think protest music, despite the music industry only wanting to release terrible cover versions, I think protest music is at a good point.
We had Annie DeFranco in our studio a while ago, and she sang the song Subdivision, which is about racism in the United States. She wanted to sing that song in the David Letterman show she was invited on. They wouldn't let her. They wanted something, as they put it, a little more upbeat. Now, you had the opportunity to sing on the David Letterman show, and you actually did sing. But can you talk about your experience, what you sang, what you said?
I think Annie DeFranco made the mistake of telling the truth beforehand and telling them what she was going to sing. So we just said we were just going to play the song as normal. And then when it came to actually filming, we just changed the words. So we were singing, you know, Free Mamir Abu Jamal. And we knew it would cause a real sort of... Basically, as soon as we came off stage and went to the dressing room, Letterman and all the rest of them were just running around saying, no, you've got to do it again. You've got to do it again with the real words. And we were like, nope, we're going. They were saying, well, we won't show it. We were like, okay, fine. When we left the building. But they had no time left, and they had nothing to fill the space with, so they had to put it on.
At the end of the show, there was a disclaimer came up on the end of the screen saying, the views expressed by the persons appearing on the show are not shared by David Letterman. And a lawyer's note at the bottom.
We're talking to Chumbawamba. Now, you gave new meaning to the term raining on someone's parade when you threw a bucket of water on Labor Government Secretary of State John Prescott a few years ago. Could you talk about that?
Well, we'd actually gone along to an awards ceremony with some dockers. There were a big dock workers dispute in Britain that the Labor government could have settled, and they just weren't interested in settling it. And the dockers had just lost the dispute from 3 years of being on strike. They'd lost the dispute. And we went along, and if we'd won anything, then the dockers were going to go up and talk about how the Labour government had basically sold them down the river. And we didn't win anything. And John Prescott was right next to us. The dockers never got their moment to be able to fight back in public. And so we just thought, these people think they're untouchable. They think that they can make decisions about people's lives where they wreck people's lives and nothing is ever going to come back at them. So it was just too much of a temptation, really. So it was for the dockers, really, that we poured water over him.
Speaking of labour issues, you've got a song you want to sing about the miners. Could you talk a little about it and why you want to sing
it? Actually, just a timely song in view of the fact that Maurice Gibb just died. And we've been doing this Bee Gees song for a long time. And we do it because everyone always thinks it's really funny that we do a Bee Gees song, but it's the first single they ever had, and it's just a beautiful song about, you know, workers being sort of sold out by the owners.
This is Chumbawamba.
In the event of something happening to me, there is something I would like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones. I keep straining my ears to hear a sound. Maybe someone is digging underground. Or have they given up and all gone home to bed, thinking those that once existed must be dead? Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like? Landslide, Mr. Jones. In the event of something happening to me, there is something I would like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Know what it's like on the outside. Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones.
Chumbawamba is going to be singing in Washington, D.C. at the anti-war protest on Saturday. It's expected more than 100,000 people will be there. Can you tell us a little about SICK? I'm looking at the magazine right now. Adventures in Anti-Capitalism. They took what they wanted, and they wanted the world.
We had this idea that we wanted to put artists and activists in the same arena, because what happens generally is that people are fighting and creating things on their own, and you end up really isolated. And because the anti-globalisation movement, the brilliant thing about it is that it's made connections with people all over the world and made people smaller. We want, you know, made the world smaller. We wanted to be part of putting people in touch with each other. So we basically made a magazine where we got other people to write for it and where we wrote for it, where we got lots of different activists. And we also use loads of writers and photographers and artists, all people that were engaged with the world and engaged in struggle. And we just put them in the same arena, which is SICK. And it's funny.
The magazine of no value.
Yeah, well, no value in terms of what capitalism terms as value, but lots of value in terms of, you know, human worth.
Many people say that popular movement is part of the problem, part of the multinational entertainment complex. What are you doing about that in terms of the money that you make?
It's funny because we, you know, from the very first time we started to sell cassette tapes that we made ourselves, we realised that we were entering into this sort of bargain situation. We were in the marketplace. We were, you know, getting involved in consumerism and all that sort of thing. So we decided that, you know, a long time ago, we decided that we ought to use that and play with it and do something with it. And so what we do is, you know, sometimes we'll get offered ridiculous amounts of money for having music on advertisements on television, and often we turn it down because it's some company that we wouldn't have anything to do with. But sometimes we get such huge offers that we think some activist group somewhere could really use this money. So we just take the money and we give it to somebody who's sort of opposed to... usually it's really nice if you give money away to somebody that's opposed to the people that we're doing the advertisement for.
If you take an ad in Italy, then you give it... Well, what we did, we took a Renault ad in Italy and we gave it to Italian pirate radio stations that were involved in struggle, and that kept them going for years. So we took an ad in South Africa and we gave it to a radical magazine so that they could keep going for years. And it's just a much better way, really, than just staying pure.
And the anti-sweatshop movement?
Yeah, it's. I mean, the anti-sweatshop movement's really good because it's the sweatshop thing is to do with globalisation, but the opposition to it is also like a really good example of globally people opposing it.
Well, Chumbawamba, what song are you going to take us out with on our show today?
Don't know. Something that Neil's going to play. Oh, yeah.
So, it's a song about mutineering. It's about the British Navy, which is meant to protect Queen and country, how basically they just thought, right, OK, we've had enough of being treated like rubbish, and it's the Salt Fair North Sea.
The soldiers mutineered.
It's the sailors mutineering.
Jacks and the deep blue sea.
Salt Fair North Sea.
Ship top rocks and cats, far as the eye can see.
Salt Fair North Sea.
Spit no mix and jacks and the deep blue sea.
Salt Fair North Sea.
Spit no rocks and cats, far as the eye can see.
Hatches batten down. Sometimes I think it must be different on land, but from the mast I can only see tyrants still in command.
Chumbawamba here at Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. If you want a copy of today's show, call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Special thanks to Orlando Richards and Simba Russo and Gabriella Weiss. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
something new.